Today on the 21st Show, we all know many of our fellow Americans are deeply divided by politics. This polarization, many argue, is among the reasons our government, especially Congress, so often disappoints. But scholar Philip Wallach says our main tool for bridging the divisions in American politics is supposed to be the Congress. Obviously, that's not happening these days, but he argues lawmakers could meet the challenge again. His book and his big idea are called Why Congress. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And I want to begin today with a question. Do you approve or disapprove of the way Congress is handling its job? The Gallup polling organization has been asking that question for decades, and if you're like most Americans, the answer is no. In fact, just 15% of us said yes in a survey late last year. And disapproval for how Congress operates is not limited to the outside. Plenty of members themselves are unhappy with how things are going. Among those heading for the exits is Marjorie Taylor Greene, the super MAGA Republican from Georgia. In a video announcing her decision not to run for re-election, she cited threats of violence, her falling out with President Trump over the Epstein files, and, more to the point for our conversation today, what it's actually like to go to work in the Congress.
With almost 1 year into our majority, the legislature has been mostly sidelined. We endured an 8-week shutdown, wrongly resulting in the House not working for the entire time. And we are entering campaign season, which means all courage leaves and only safe campaign reelection mode is turned on in the House of Representatives.
Across the aisle, Jared Golden, the relatively young Democratic congressman from Maine, also decided not to run again. In a newspaper essay explaining his decision, he said, "I don't fear losing. What has become apparent to me is that I now dread the prospect of winning. Simply put, what I could accomplish in this increasingly unproductive Congress pales in comparison to what I could do in that time as a husband, a father, and a son." On top of that, congressional majorities are insecure, with the parties exchanging the big gavel every few years, and Republicans seem to be going through speakers faster than Spinal Tap went through drummers. But my guest today says the future of American constitutional democracy depends not on better presidential candidates or more ethical judges, but on Congress getting its act together. Philip A. Wallach is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's previously been affiliated with the Brookings Institution, and he earned a Ph.D. in politics at Princeton. More to the point for our conversation, he's the author of the book Why Congress, which was published by Oxford University Press. It came out in 2023, but it is every bit as relevant today. Congress has not always been as it is now, he writes in the introduction. Indeed, it flourished in some of the last century's most difficult moments. Even today, if legislators want to make their institution more than a venue for the two parties to insult each other, they can reorganize it to make it so. Philip joined me for a conversation that first aired last year, which means we're not taking calls on the program today, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. Philip Wallach, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me and for that kind introduction.
So I'm borrowing my first question from the title of your book, Why Congress?
No question mark in the title. There is an answer. America is an exceptionally diverse country and has been throughout its history. And we have to find a way to make all of the different factions in our extended republic accommodate each other and come to workable solutions on the leading problems of the day. And to work through those differences and get to those solutions We need a body that actually represents that difference and gets people talking, that creates the possibilities for surprising coalitions. And Congress is really what the Constitution gives us to perform that function. The presidency, which of course has become a more and more powerful institution throughout American history, but especially in the last 50 years or so, is really terribly suited to the purpose. If we try to reduce all of American politics to the question of who are you for and who are you against once every 4 years, we get everyone into a very zero-sum mindset of combat and enmity. Congress at its best can create a much more positive-sum attitude where we feel like there's interesting bargains to be made and strange bedfellows to be sought out on various issues. So a politics that's more centered on Congress is a slightly less heated politics, a more incrementalist and transactional politics. And when I look at what's happening in 2025, that sure sounds like a welcome prescription.
Now, you said that, you know, the presidential election has really become the focus of our, at least sort of the way most people think about politics in America. And there are serious people who have spent their careers trying to make it so that the executive branch could run more and more of the government. Talk more about what the issue is with that you see.
Well, listen, the federal government is a very big and powerful organization with many parts. The president is necessarily going to be a very powerful figure because of his duties as commander-in-chief and as the top administrator in the executive branch. So even in my wildest dreams, the president is still a very powerful person. But, you know, what we've seen more and more in recent decades is the president becoming a de facto lawmaker unto himself, where we see an awful lot of policies sort of dreamed up by the executive branch and justified through aggressive interpretations of existing statutes that Congress has built up over the last century that do give a lot of discretionary powers to the executive branch. But more and more we find the president working around Congress rather than through Congress. And that's a very dangerous dynamic. It leads us to very opportunistic, short-sighted policymaking, I think. But it more importantly, it really leaves us with a crisis of legitimacy for an awful lot of policies, where you see presidents sort of hanging their hat on these legally dubious interpretations, where we all then line up at the Supreme Court waiting to see what these nine justices will make of it. That's a crazy way to conduct our politics. It makes so much more sense to try to work out our differences in advance through actual deliberation and attempt to persuade each other in the legislature.
Yeah, maybe we should be specific about this, right? This is Obama's, what was it, pen and phone policy. It's President Biden, you know, sort of figuring out ways to try and forgive student loans. It's President Trump finding, you know, emergency money from the defense budget, if I remember correctly, to build the wall. Talk about some of the examples.
Yeah, all those things you said were right on. I mean, Obama's signature immigration reform, right, DACA, is a program created
for the kids who came here.
After Obama had said, I don't think we can fix this without an act of Congress. He had been saying that for years. And then all of a sudden he said, well, actually, since the executive branch has all the prosecutorial discretion, we can just decide not to prosecute these people and to, in fact, create a permitting program for them. That was all done without any input from Congress, very much with the knowledge that majorities in Congress would not support that policy. And it's created this decade-long legal saga for all those folks put into this legal gray area because of that policy. You know, the very sympathetic group of people who were brought to this country illegally by their parents when they were children, they all just remain, you know, sort of in between legal and illegal. But we sort of are in this mindset of get the president to do what he can, and we don't even try to go to Congress anymore. When's the last time Congress made a really serious attempt to deal with these really bad holes in our immigration system, which I think both parties now acknowledge is fundamentally broken, but we don't even make a run at a bipartisan compromise that could fix things. Trump 2025 has you know, built on these existing trends. You know, the tariff policy, the president's signature policy, in some ways built on an hyper aggressive interpretation of an emergency power statute that has never been used in this way at all, and that we're now waiting to see whether the Supreme Court will strike down or uphold. It just seems like we're more and more leaning on the executive branch to be the first mover and the last mover in our system, rather than running things through Congress where the Constitution really requires they go.
You know, you talk about immigration quite a bit in the book as one of the real points of friction in American politics that could really use some good congressional deliberation. And I, this is something I've followed because, of course, our senior Illinois U.S. Senator, outgoing now, Dick Durbin, has long been a lead sponsor of the DREAM Act. And he co-sponsored that for as long as I can remember with Senator Lindsey Graham, although, as you know, by 20, you know, they were enthusiastic about it for a long time. But then by 2022, I remember in the statement they put out announcing their reintroduction of the DREAM Act. And again, this is for young people who were brought here as immigrants. You know, they couldn't really make their own decisions at the age they were. And now they're stuck. They don't have legal status in the country beyond, you know, what DACA has afforded them. So when Graham and Durbin issue their statement in 2022, he says, you know, he doesn't expect it to pass, basically. So he's almost going through the motions of the sort of bipartisan work of Congress, but sort of throwing cold water on it at the same time. Do you see this? Talk about how this maybe is emblematic of some of the issues you're talking about.
Yeah, well, immigration is one issue that for a while Congress really was trying, and you would even say that the leaders from both parties at various moments got behind big reform bills and tried to move them. The problem with immigration was that you've had a group of hawks, of skeptics about the value of immigration and people who are worried about the dangers from illegal immigration, who have really just felt excluded from deliberations. They feel very burned by the way that the 1986 Immigration Reform Act played out, this bill that included an amnesty provision that Ronald Reagan signed into law. They felt like they were bamboozled, essentially, the immigration skeptics, and they don't want to get bamboozled again. And so they really have found a way to effectively blow up every single one of these deals that leaders have tried to push through. And we've never managed to have a debate where we really bring them in and say, okay, well, what's your solution? You know, unfortunately, their solution in recent years has just been to say, well, get Donald Trump into office. And that's the only solution we need. And the president himself harken back to that view in one of his early speeches in 2025. But if you actually want to fix the law on a long-term basis so that it's not just going to be that the next Democratic president comes in and does things that you think are terrible, you would think you would actually want to amend what's there on the law books. And lawmakers have kind of resign themselves to this idea that Congress never is going to do anything more. And that's a pretty depressing starting place for the discussion. So, yeah, I think an awful lot of members themselves feel trapped and feel they have a kind of learned helplessness. They just assume that nothing is going to happen. So it's a tough mindset to break out of. But again, Congress has not always been so useless seeming as it's been for the last few years. And it's up to the members themselves to jumpstart it.
Yeah. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show, and we're talking with Philip Wallach, who's the author of the book, Why Congress. We asked members of our texting group, How well do you think the Congress handles its job? And what about your local representative? And how do you feel about lawmakers compromising on the issues you hold most dear in order to make agreements with the other party? Terry in Batavia says, if times were normal, it would be normal to see our congresspersons working across the aisle for the betterment of both their constituents and the country. Times are not normal, sadly. The polarization means no one seems to be working for their constituents, but only towing their party's line. I hope we can get back to bridging the differences, as Wallach says, for the betterment of all the people in this country. Meanwhile, a different Terry, this one in Champaign, says Congress may once have been our best tool for bridging political divides, but those days are long over. Even before Citizens United, the Congress has tilted toward the interests of donors and major corporations over the interests of people. The crazy idea at the core of Citizens United, money is speech, has only made it worse. I'm 76 years old, and I can say that it has been at least 30 years since Congress has worked on my behalf instead of the moneyed interests. You know, we need to take a break in about a minute here, Philip. So, you know, but before we do, I just want to ask you to sort of like briefly set up this idea that, you know, we should be paying more attention to process as opposed, you know, it's really processes where this has fallen down, yeah. Not necessarily policy.
Yeah, it really matters how we get to our decisions. And what Congress offers is a sense of listening to each other, sort of accepting that you need to meet people where they are and work with them from there. You need to not just assume that the other guy is so terrible that he ought to be excluded from the decision making. And by bringing everybody in to decision making together, you get people to accept the legitimacy of what's decided rather than just saying, oh, well, that's a big fraud on behalf of people who aren't like me. You really have to. This is our way of building up trust for the government. And again, I think it doesn't have to be so pretty or lovely seeming to most people to work well, but there has to be a core of trustworthiness.
Yeah.
And the process is what can deliver that.
I love some of the old quotes in the book you have, like from decades ago, about how, you know, if you're in Congress, you should expect to be hated by most Americans. That's the job. All right, we're going to continue with Philip Wallach after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our guest for the hour is Philip Wallach, author of the book Why Congress and a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He was previously part of the Brookings Institution. We're listening back to our conversation today on the current state of American politics and what the heck happened to the separation of powers, co-equal branches of government, and all that other stuff we learned about in civics class. We asked members of our texting group about this when this first aired last year. Gene in Cobden says, Congress right now is a pathetic tool of the president. It doesn't need to be that way, and the midterms have the potential to solve that. Everyone of sense and integrity needs to get out the vote. Since our program was recorded today, no live calls, but you can still let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. I can imagine somebody giving a sort of equal and opposite post to Gene a couple of years back during the height of some of the COVID disputes in our country, talking about the importance of voting in that election as well. So, you know, there are always these shifting coalitions and factions and Philip, your book starts with kind of a historical survey of what Congress is supposed to be. So maybe we can just talk briefly about Madison and taming the mischiefs of faction, as he puts it.
Sure. So the very classic Federalist Paper number 10, one of the ones people get assigned most in their civics classes, you know, talks about why an extended republic is a good experiment to be making. There was really no historical parallel for it when the framers set it up. And Madison's vision is that nobody's going to be able to dominate because this country is such a complicated place. You have differing economic interests and regional interests, religious groups, different ways of thinking. So you're going to have a lot of people forming factions, and Madison does say that's That's not something to celebrate. Faction is a problem. The mischiefs of faction is one of the fundamental problems of politics in a free society. But he says it's just part of the price you pay for being free and for the fact that you're allowing people who are so different to come into a union together. So you have to find a way to get these people arguing and working things out. And Congress is where it's going to happen. The framers didn't design Congress with that in mind. They took it for granted that the legislature was the beating heart of government. That's what they had known from their experience in the 13 colonies. That was very fundamental to what they thought of as the tradition of English political liberty, which they all subscribed to. Was this very vital form of representation where the diversity of voices coming together in the legislature was really central. And of course, the inadequacy of representation of Americans in the English Parliament is why we broke away from them in the first place. So Madison actually worried that Congress would be an impetuous vortex drawing everything into its orbit. There was this just assumption that it was going to be this very powerful sort of body. And I think for a lot of the 19th century American history, that looks like a fair assumption. I think beginning in the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th, you see power shifting toward the executive branch mostly.
All right, let's talk a little bit. There's so much more we could talk about in terms of, you know, how Madison envisioned Congress and some of the changes that were made over time, Woodrow Wilson in particular. But given our limited time today, I think I want to move ahead to like a couple of the examples you give in the book of when Congress functioned really well, right, in a way that popular history often overlooks in favor of the idea that it was, you know, all the president kind of working his will in Washington. One is World War II. The other is during the Civil Rights era, right? There was a lot of obstruction from Southern lawmakers. Make the case, though, that Congress was actually functioning at its best in that time.
For the Civil Rights era, yeah. And people have the sense, why did we finally pass the civil rights laws that got desegregation effectuated, right, in our schools and in our public places in a way that, like, the Supreme Court decision of Brown v. Board of Education had really failed to do in the 1950s. Why did we get this through Congress? And people, I think the popular imagination tells us, well, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement sort of created this huge storm of energy in favor of this change, and then you got Kennedy assassinated and Johnson coming in, somebody who had sort of an iron will and the ability to put the squeeze on lawmakers to get it through in a way that hadn't happened before. And there's definitely some truth to that story, but I want to emphasize just how much the process that had to play out in Congress shaped that whole story, and how Johnson's role can really be pretty easily exaggerated. So why did the civil rights organizations work so hard to build up such a broad coalition, not just amongst blacks who had the most to gain, but among Midwestern whites who mostly didn't have any black people living around them? How did they decide to make these people part of their moral crusade?
Everett Dirksen of Illinois, right?
Yes. Well, Dirksen of Illinois was the Senate minority leader, and he was pretty committed to civil rights, I think you'd have to say. But some of, like, Hickenlooper of Iowa or somebody like that, where you had to get people convinced and get people willing to fight who were mostly indifferent. And I think the reason is that they knew they had to build up this huge coalition in the Congress. And of course, that made it harder. And they may have succeeded earlier had they not had to do that. But having to go through that process actually persuaded people. It actually built this huge juggernaut for civil rights that finally was able to push it across the line in 1964. And that led the Southerners to ultimately accept their loss. They realized that they were kind of completely outflanked and that they didn't have any other option but to accept. But they were also given the chance to make their case. I think that's what the stories about Johnson sort of looming over figures and bullying them into accepting don't appreciate, is that we had a different Senate majority leader at this time. His name was Mike Mansfield, a great leader who was there for decades. And Mansfield had the idea to really give his Southern Democrat colleagues their chance to make their case, and he remained on very good terms with them. And so at the end of the process, they said, "We hate this law. This is terrible." They did filibuster. Their filibuster had to be broken, which was a much more exceptional act back then. But at the end of the day, they were willing to say, "Okay, the process has legitimately played itself out. We don't like this law, but it is now the law of the land. We will go tell our constituents that they need to obey it." That just seems like such a such a contrast to the way people think about the process today, where we say, "Well, you know, Joe Biden wants to do climate change in a way that doesn't involve Congress at all. No doubt that's illegal. Let's go to court and fight out whether we can knock this off the books." Right? That we have so much of our policy today where people don't accept the legitimacy, try to undermine the legality. It's such a stark contrast to Civil Rights Act, at this huge social change that we managed to push through and that was really never reopened after 1964. A fact about American life that's really too little remarked upon, in my view.
Do you think, I mean, what would you say is the last major time episode in American life when Congress kind of worked as it's intended to? I mean, would you accept the Affordable Care Act as a hypothesis for that, right? Filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, although, you know, I'm sure we can debate on the margins of that, but, you know, made it through the House. And yet it's something that, I mean, we're still debating this year, some of the provisions.
Well, I think to make such a huge change to our entitlement system on the basis of a completely party line vote is something quite new in American history. If you go back to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of those things passed with overwhelming majorities in Congress, which isn't to say they were completely uncontroversial or anything, but you brought in people to accept the outcome. That didn't happen with Obamacare and with the Dodd-Frank Act, the other big achievement of that first 2 years of Obama's term in office. Republicans were completely unreconciled to those things, and they were devoted to undoing them to some extent. Now, as it turned out, they weren't completely clear on which parts they wanted to overturn or how, and so a lot of that still endures. And so, you know, the Democratic leaders from that time, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, you know, were they to look back on that from the present, they might say, "Well, it was worth it. We got it through. We played by the rules and got it through. So there, we helped America for the better." But that really is not an ideal way of legislating, where you just have one party get the bare minimum of votes that they need to push something through and impose it. The process really is supposed to be more about accommodation and figuring out a way you can get everyone to live with it.
As I recall, I think those are very fair points. And as I recall, like you say, there wasn't much interest in trying to come to, that I recall, for workable solutions across the aisle at that time, at least. You know,
yeah. So I think it's important to say these are pretty broad generalizations that I've been speaking in here. So we shouldn't give the impression that just everything about Congress in recent years is completely broken. That's very much not the case. I think things could be much worse And maybe they're getting worse. We don't have to go that far back to see things working acceptably well. And so, even today we've got a National Defense Authorization Act getting passed by big bipartisan majorities every single year. That's an extremely important process that gives legitimacy to our defense establishment. And even in 2025, as bad as political acrimony is today, I think it's still pretty likely that we'll get this bill across the line and it will pass with big bipartisan majorities. That's not nothing. We should be grateful for that much functionality. And the Armed Services Committees in both the House and the Senate work very well in bipartisan ways. Appropriations process, not so long ago, you might say a pretty similar thing about it. We found ways to make deals that everyone could accept. Now, this year, we've not really seen that. And it's an open question whether we're just going to sort of try to kick the can with more and more continuing resolutions and assume that the executive branch is going to do a lot of adjustments on the back end of spending. That's kind of a scary new frontier in congressional dysfunction, because even in the first Trump administration, we had bipartisan appropriation laws in the Biden administration as well. So that's one of the things I'm most worried about in 2025.
Yeah, tell me about it. Here in public media, we know that all too well, that what is agreed to in bipartisan spending bills can certainly be, I don't know what the verb is for rescinded, but rescinded by the executive. Rescinded, yes, thank you, by the executive branch. So, look, we need to take a break in another few minutes here, but maybe we can sort of jump forward. There's a lot of history that you cover in your book, Why Congress, about, so a lot of the changes that follow the Civil Rights Great Society, Vietnam, Watergate, conservatives and Republicans turning their attention to the presidency and the courts, the Republican Revolution, as it was called in 1994. What are if you had to pick, a handful or even one of the biggest changes that set Congress on the path towards its current levels of dysfunction and irrelevance? What is the pivot point?
Well, I would try to draw people's attention to a fact that I think most people don't think about now. A lot of your listeners surely are too young to remember it. The Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for four uninterrupted decades, from 1955 until the end of 1994. That's a long time for a party to spend out in the political wilderness. And of course, Republicans did control the Senate from 81 to 86. But for the most part, Republicans were a minority party for a very long time, even as they were able to win the presidency. And so, yeah, I'd say that it's important to understand how skeptical of Congress, how cynical about Congress Republicans became in the 1980s. And that led to the rise of Newt Gingrich and his stature in the House of Representatives. He became the leader that led Republicans back to the majority in 1995. He had a very conflictual view of how politics should play out, but really, so he became the leader of this institution, Congress, that from my point of view ought to be about accommodating, about compromise, about incrementalism. And that's not how Gingrich thought at all. He wanted big clashes with the Clinton administration, and he got them. So he was a pivotal figure in bringing us to this era of constant partisan combat. That is, in fact, he believed that was a good thing, that it made a clear choice for the American people that they could render in elections, and then the majority could go and impose its will. So that's the vision that we're living with for the 21st century, for most people, that's their whole recollection of American politics. That's not the only way that American politics can work. And I think, my hope is that at some point we're just going to become exhausted by it.
Yeah, yeah.
That we can see the downsides of this, full contact sport way of doing politics, becoming more and more clear every day, and think about ways to turn the temperature down.
Okay, we're going to take another break. We're listening back to my conversation with Philip Wallach, author of Why Congress. It's a statement, not a question, When we return, we'll touch on some of the ways Congress can renew itself. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Throughout the hour, we've been listening back to our conversation with Philip Wallach, author of Why Congress. We talked about the current state of American politics and why it's his view that the thing we need to save us is for Congress to reclaim its power and its rightful place in our system of government. We got text messages from listeners when this first aired last year. Sarah in Rockford says, "I think the recent Congress is doing a terrible job. Since the rise of the online personality and echo chambers, we have lost a lot of middle ground. They are supposed to compromise and to make a livable middle ground for everyone. I want congressmen to be banned from becoming lobbyists, tighter controls around social media usage, and banned from stock market trading while active duty. I also want to see a pay freeze whenever there's a government shutdown, must be in person for all voting, and no running for re-election until 365 calendar days before the voting date. We need to put modern boundaries for the modern era, incentivize them to work together." Sarah, thank you for that message. We also heard from you over the phones during this program when it was first broadcast late last year, and let's now get back to the interview, and we'll start with a call from John in Rockford.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Here's my question for your guest. There seems to be two factors, at least, that must be responsible, at least in part, for the dysfunction of the House of Representatives. One is partisan gerrymandering. That is, created a House of Representatives wherein over 90% of the members live in safe Democratic or Republican districts. This means the people in those districts are deprived of a meaningful election day experience, and the people who do not live in those districts generally call the shots about who's going to be in leadership roles in the House of Representatives. The other thing is what I call the demographic dilution of the popular will. In 1913, there were 435 Congress members. More than a century later, we still have only 435 Congress members, and they represent districts, as you can see. I'm in the 16th district in Illinois, that is so big and so diverse that there's no personal contact, no feeling of personal contact with the person who represents us in Congress, and therefore that person feels no obligation to listen to any of us at any for any length of time. So that's my question.
John, great points. Thank you so much for calling in. Philip, how about it?
John, great questions. I think the underlying thrust of both of your questions is really what is the electoral process by which we're choosing the people who go to Congress, and is something about the way Congress operates just inevitable given the way we choose our representatives? I don't actually think it is. I share a lot of the concerns about primary electorates being unrepresentative. I share the concerns about gerrymandering and politicians picking their voters rather than voters picking their politicians. So I do share those things. But at the end of the day, the chamber is still amenable to the will of these members. And I don't actually think a lot of members of Congress are so happy with the way things are today. The show's intro started off with a lot of unhappy comments from Marjorie Taylor Greene, which was a little rich because she sort of is one of the people who has leaned into partisan enmity harder than anybody else up until the last few weeks. But I think you have a lot of members who want to accomplish good things for their constituents and feel intensely frustrated by the way the chamber is set up today. You don't have a lot of reform consciousness sort of creating a movement for change yet. It's sort of incipient. So we have to find ways to get some of these members. I think there are a lot of good people in Congress who wish things would work differently. So we have to find a way to empower those members rather than having them feel like the odd ones out who then just retire or go do something else because they're so frustrated with the place.
This is a classic situation for me, the triumph of hope over our clock. I have so many topics that I wanted to talk to you about that we're just not going to have time for, including some very live current events involving Speaker Johnson. You had a great piece, might have been a year ago now, comparing him to Sam Rayburn, or, you know, his potential at least when he was still fairly new to the job. It seems like his job may be in danger now. You had another great piece just in the last day or so about the redistricting fight happening across the country this year through the lens of specifically what's happening in Indiana. But, you know, those will have to wait for another day, because I do want to spend some time in the last 9 or so minutes we have talking about your potential futures for Congress,
yeah,
which you call decrepitude, rubber stamp, or revival. Maybe we can take those in turn. What does decrepitude look like? Seems like we may be on that track right now.
Yeah, decrepitude is more of the same, unfortunately, and maybe is the most likely path, where we just get more and more comfortable with the idea that Congress is a place where we fight with each other, not a place where we make decisions. And we assume that the executive branch and the judiciary are the ones doing the real policy work out in the country. I think, you know, and the members of Congress themselves get more and more comfortable with that idea. They see themselves as cheerleaders or, critics more than lawmakers. So I think we're headed in that direction already, unfortunately. Rubber stamp, you know, we hear that phrase a lot with the Republican Congress in 2025. In my view, they're not a very good rubber stamp, even, because on an awful lot of things, they don't actually put their mark of approval on what the president is doing. They just stand off to the side and say they like it, but they're not working anything through the legislative process. When we think of a rubber stamp Congress, it's one that pushes through whatever the president wants in a big hurry. So, you know, you could say this about the first days of the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt. That was a Congress that would pass anything that the president sent over. It was a huge, huge partisan majority, and they did not spend much time thinking about it. They just pushed legislation through. We could see reforms, maybe in scare quotes there, reforms made to Congress to make it a more amenable rubber stamp. And I worry about that people think that Congress is so obnoxious, well, the thing to do is make it less prominent, make it a more reliable rubber stamp. And that would solve some problems in some ways. It would sort of streamline some legal questions that are now rather thorny. But it would really be a threat to Americans' political liberty to be dramatic about it.
At the sort of easy end of that spectrum is, you know, getting rid of the filibuster. At the far end, you know, maybe you have in the book a house of, you know, 1776 members, then, you know, in a constitutional amendment that lets the president basically dictate the agenda, you know, sort of a parliamentary
right.
system without the escape valve of being able to fire the prime minister on a moment's
yeah.
notice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I a lot of people share the previous caller's desire to increase the size of the House. Within reason, maybe I can get a little excited about that as sort of a goad to change. But if you make the body really big, such that, you know, we're sending one member for every couple hundred thousand people, I think it would become a totally fake place. We wouldn't even be able to have the pretense of this being a deliberative body at all. It would be it would just be a ratifying body, really. And I think we would lose the sense that we can have political debates that end in compromises other than the ones dictated by the president. So I think, unfortunately, that would end up making the president an even more dominant figure than he is today. And that's not something I'm eager to do. So the last scenario of the book is to try to come up with a scenario for a revival where somehow Congress reasserts its centrality and we get American citizens expecting that big, important debates are going to be fought out there to some sort of acceptable resolution. And frankly, you know, I try to imagine sort of some counterfactual history scenarios where these changes come to pass. And that's one of my favorite parts of the book, one that a lot of people enjoy, I know. The one that I have for revival does not strike me as terribly plausible when I read it today. You have to
a
have
mere
some
two and
issue.
A half years later, yeah.
Yeah, you have to have some issue that's cross-cutting across the parties, where you get some Republicans and Democrats saying, actually, action on this issue is more important to me than partisan loyalty.
You know, an issue like a global pandemic, maybe?
You know, you might have thought, but that was definitely not it.
How about an attack on our seat of government?
Yes. Well, a hot war with China is the one that I think would really scramble our political lines today in ways that would be hard to predict. Certainly, that's not anything any of us should wish for.
No.
Sometimes I look at there's sort of a cross-cutting political coalition out there oriented around issues of big tech and maybe the role of AI will even heighten the salience of these questions. You see, Vice President Vance and Elizabeth Warren find a lot of common ground on these things. So there might be something there that would be capable of reorganizing our politics. But man, our partisan leaders are really good at getting people dug in on the lines that we have today. They've sort of managed to stretch out this political moment and deepen people's feelings of, and not so much of loyalty to one party, but of hatred for the other party. So I've stopped betting on any given year as being the time when we're going to see a turnaround, because it does seem like the trend is running in the opposite direction.
Well, what hope do we have? I mean, you write in the book that, you know, in order to reclaim their power, individual members of Congress will have to decide that being reduced to voting on command is beneath their constitutional dignity. You know, I've known some people who have gone to Congress because I covered the Illinois State Legislature for a long time here before taking this job. And, you know, I knew people who moved up, so to speak, into Congress. And, you know, they all seem like much more reasonable people at the time. They seem like reasonable people when you talk to them when the microphones are off. And yet what I've seen from them, and this is bipartisan to some extent, I don't know that they have floors on their constitutional dignity. What have you heard from members of Congress since this, you know, you've really dug into this work?
I think a lot of them say yes, but, right? And it really is I don't want to suggest that it would just be easy as snapping their fingers to change the environment, because the truth is most of them really are very earnest in believing that it is of paramount importance for their party to win the next election. People really have this mindset, the next election is the most important in our country's history. You hear that cycle after cycle after cycle, and I, for one, get pretty tired of it, but people really do talk themselves into it. And if you feel that way sincerely, and I believe people really do, then it makes sense to just figure out how can my team make the other team look as bad as possible ahead of this next election so that we can get control. That really is a sensible mindset, even for people who wish things could be different. They feel like that's where things are today. And so we're in this bad equilibrium that's hard to find our way out of. It may take one party finally figuring out a way to smash through to a dominant majority position. Neither party seems very good at that in the last few years, and that's kind of another puzzle worth thinking about. But members do feel stuck because they want to support their leaders in as much as their leaders are helping tee up the next election. And I myself am sort of an alienated political person. I've never felt terribly close to either political party, and so it's easy for me to say, you should all be less partisan. The folks who get elected to Congress don't feel that way.
No, they don't.
They're earnest partisans.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Philip Wallach is the author of Why Congress. It's a really interesting read. I recommend it. It's been a great conversation. I hope we can talk again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book again is Why Congress. The author is Philip Wallach. And that is all the time we have today on The 21st Show. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Colleen Shogan, former archivist of the United States, the person responsible for safeguarding federal records. It's traditionally been a nonpartisan post, but Shogan was one of the first high-profile officials fired by President Trump. That's tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.